are listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to State of the Art with Michael Sterling and Paul Strolley right here on LA Talk Radio.
Yes, you are, and it's a week away from spring, from the official
start of spring. It's a week
next
away.
Week.
It's gorgeous, and everyone in the world who is not in Southern California is just like hating us because we've had spring for months now.
Exactly. Yeah.
My mother talked to her the other day. I am so friggin' sick of this. My mother, you know how she is. Yeah, because she sent me pictures of her backyard, and it just looks like
the snow. Yeah, it's still snowing.
Oh, no, and, they're teased, you know. It's like, oh, it's going to stop, and then it's not going to stop, and it's going to stop, and it's not going to stop, and my mother is just completely over it.
Well, I feel sorry for our friends there on the East Coast for that, but, you know, there's many other redeeming qualities about where they live, right?
There is. Oh, like the seasons.
Yeah, you know? Like the seasons, which I actually would like to see.
I told you what Peter Riegert said to me, right? Drop a name there. Whoa, hello.
Yeah, exactly.
Peter Riegert, Monica and I were first out here, he said, you know, there's no sense of the passing of time in Los Angeles because there's no seasons. He said, so let me tell you what living in Los Angeles is like. He says, you make a drink, you go down to the pool, and then you're 80. That's what I just loved. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Breakdown Services, the entertainment industry standard used around the world, providing the most professional means to reach talent agents as well as actors when casting a project. To learn more about Breakdown Services, visit BreakdownExpress.com.
We'd also like to acknowledge PerformingArtsLive.com, one of the Internet's most prominent listing sources for the live arts in Southern California. We're grateful to Performing Arts Live for lending their support to our live arts calendar.
We have a couple of in-studio guests today. I'll start introducing the first one, and we'll chat with them shortly, but it's 1952, and you are a member of the studio audience awaiting the filming of two hilarious and oh-so-familiar I Love Lucy episodes. Imagine stepping back in time onto the Desilu Playhouse soundstage, where a charming host entertains and enlightens you to the behind-the-scenes filming process, the 1950s high-fidelity technology, and this brand-new thing called television. Well, you don't have to imagine it, because you can just go to Costa Mesa to experience it. Joining us shortly to discuss the only L.A.-area performance of the national tour of I Love Lucy Live on Stage is producer and co-adapter and all-around very funny lady, Kim Flagg, is with us. Hi, Kim.
Hello, Kim.
Hi. Thanks for coming.
And later in the hour, ladies and gentlemen, Phantom Projects Theater Group has sought to provide a platform for young adults while providing a serious, in-depth examination of real, hard-hitting issues they encounter. Messages and realities provided during these plays have taken a very pull-no-punches stance in the hopes that lessons can be learned while opening up the lines of communication between parents and teens. Since 1997, Phantom Projects Theater Group has toured throughout California, and here to talk about their current offering and the 17th anniversary of the organization he created at 17 years of age, I might add. Please say hello to Steve Cisneros.
Very well done.
Yes.
That was beautiful. I had to ask him, and I had you 50-50 on whether you were going to get that one.
Oh, really?
But you did very well.
No, I've been looking at that name for a couple of weeks.
Yeah? Okay.
What is
the origin of that, Steve?
It's Mexican.
It's Mexican?
Yes, I am.
Cisneros.
Yeah. Cisneros.
Because, I mean, I'm sure you could get the Greek thing, too.
Italian I've been asked a lot, actually.
Really?
Well, but I am Mexican.
How else would you pronounce it than how I pronounced it?
Oh, I don't know. Cisneros. I was more accent. Cisneros. Cisneros. Cis, you know, just the accent thing.
Cisnerosis.
Okay. Cisnerosis.
Which is something I've encountered.
But I had that in college. A little penicillin cleared it right up. What's the origin of your name?
Flag.
No, I.
I don't know.
Don't lose me in the jargon, Kim.
English.
Scottish.
I'm kind of making this up.
But I mean, no, it is. It is just. It's not changed. It's not a showbiz change name. It's your actual name.
Oh no!
Name?
Yes.
Okay.
Because it has two G's.
Yeah.
To distinguish me from a. Piece of cloth.
But doesn't Fanny Flagg have two G's?
She does.
No relation?
No, but I pretend sometimes.
Oh. When it benefits
you. I would say
you.
She's my aunt. See if anyone buys it. Most younger people have no idea what I'm talking about. So.
Oh.
Sadly.
Yeah. Well, fried green tomatoes, maybe.
Maybe. They would know from that.
Candy Camera, not so
what
much.
What show was she on?
Fried Green Tomatoes.
She wrote Fried Green Tomatoes.
Fanny Flagg.
Yeah. Fanny Flagg wrote Fried Green Tomatoes.
I saw the movie. I loved it, but I don't remember that.
So before we get to our guest, Michael, how was your week?
It was good. Full out with theater, and we had the wonderful Jason Graw headline our stage at Sterling's upstairs at the Federal.
Yeah, I saw the pictures on Faccio di Libro.
Yes. And a phenomenal show he brought in. It was kind of a cool evening.
He always burns
it
down.
A lot of wonderful people in the audience who were friends of Jason Graw's, who's a Broadway star and a television boy, and just multi-talented, funny guy, like, you know, funny lady like you, and Joanne Worley was there, and that's exactly what she did, because we were blessed by having June Sprigg in the audience, who just was the Academy nominee for her performance in Nebraska.
Oh, right. She was hysterical.
And Joanne just happened to pass her and did that. Oh. That's
woo-hoo!
And she said, "Ladies and gentlemen, Joanne Sprigg, you know, and it's here in the house." And everyone turned around and burst into applause. And Nancy Dussault and on and on, a list of all those kinds of people.
You have such an exciting life.
Well,
I was bleaching my toilet.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, that's what I was doing.
Well, I hope you weren't sitting on it at the time.
I had actually a very embarrassing thing happen to me on the way here today. And it just, this is something, just if the listeners need a little hint of something, a little hint from Heloise, or social hint from Heloise, don't offer anything to a homeless person until you're absolutely sure that they're homeless. Because it can be awkward.
Yes.
Because I offered something to somebody, and they were fine. They were covered. Everything was okay with them. It was just,
are you kidding?
They just made a fashion choice. No, because I don't. I keep cards with me. I keep Subway cards for Subway sandwiches, and Pollo Loco cards, and things like that. And I have those $5 cards with me, and when people ask me for stuff, I give them that, because I figure that's a good way to do it.
Very, very smart thing.
This particular time, I gave a $5 Subway card to the woman who was actually cleaning the windows of the place. Well, I got out of it, I think, because I gave it to her. She's like, "And what's this for?" And I realized at that moment, this person doesn't need my help. And I just said, "Oh, I thought you dropped it. I thought you dropped it."
I pulled it out of the proverbial
you know what.
Hey, before you go on, yes. I just wanted to say that also one of the people in the audience at the club on Monday night for Jason Graw was Liam Bonner, the rage of Los Angeles right now. As far as the critics are concerned, he's playing the title role of Billy in Billy Budd.
In Billy Budd, the one we talked about last week.
The Los Angeles Opera at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. And boy, was he a spectacular fellow. He was actually sitting at my table. And couldn't have been nicer. Couldn't have been more thrilled to be there. Have a night off from the opera.
Maybe he'll do a show there.
Maybe.
Oh.
Yeah.
Cool.
We'll see.
All right. Let's see. Let me see. Here we go. Our first guest is a writer for ABC's sitcoms Last Comic Standing and
Last Man Standing.
I was close. And that's my typing, I
it's
tell you.
Okay.
And Home Improvement. She has collaborated with Tim Allen, I got that right, for 17 years as his head comedy writer, has written on feature films with Disney, Universal, and Fox, and has developed two sitcom pilots for Boxing Cat Entertainment. For stage, she co-wrote, directed, and produced Life on Mars and co-developed the Las Vegas Stage Show, also for Mr. Allen. Today she's talking I Love Lucy live on stage, the smash hit musical theater event. Please welcome, no relation to Fanny, Kim Flagg as well.
Hello, Kim.
Hello.
Maxine Lapidus, what does that name mean to you? Anything?
Maxine Lapidus, yes.
Home Improvement.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow, that was a while ago.
Yeah, she's a friend of mine.
You know Max? Oh.
I do. Talented lady.
I will say so.
Yeah.
Who is Maxine Lapidus?
Isn't your business.
What? It's none of your business.
I have the controls here. I could just turn you off.
She's been on the show before.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she's a wonderful...
188 shows, Michael. You got to help me.
She's a television writer of note.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Ellen,
writer. I was trying
Ellen,
to... Okay,
and,
I got you.
All
right.
All those things.
Well, let's talk to this writer,
yes,
shall we?
Miss Flagg,
Kim,
with two G's.
Here's the thing about I Love Lucy Live, and I want you to share this with the listeners, because I think when
people first hear it, it's like, oh, okay, it's going to be two episodes performed live. What is so wonderful about it, having seen it a number of times as I have, is the world that is created before you're even in the theater, that time period is created. How was that arrived at creatively as you guys were gearing up for it? And how did that sort of morph during the writing process of putting it together?
We wanted to really create an experience. And in fact, I have this, I found this great photograph on the internet. It's a black and white from 1951, and it's a bunch of a studio audience on the sidewalk waiting to go into the Desilu Playhouse to see a filming of the episode. And I was wondering, what are they about to experience? And that's what our show really does. Our audience that comes into the theater is really that audience on the sidewalk, minus the ladies' hats and pocketbooks and and whatnot. But it's going.
But it's peppered and salted with actual cast members, you know, in that group too.
Exactly, among the
civilians,
audience people standing in line and coming into the theater before they sit down. Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
right.
And a lot of people think that's just some wacky Lucy fans that came dressed up in the 50s.
Right. And it's important
and
to
we
stress,
do have those, too.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. But it's important to stress, too, that it's not so much I'm always hesitant to say interactive theater because people immediately think I'm going to be dragged up on stage and thrown on a pony or something. But it's environmental theater. It's environmental because the whole world is created to just, you know, replicate that world before the actual taping. I'm making air quotes now. Taping. All of a sudden I realize I'm on radio. But now the two episodes that were chosen, how were they arrived at? Was that sort of dictated by the limitations of a live stage show or...
You are correct, sir.
Yeah. Okay.
It was tricky. It was very tricky because there's 179 episodes. So what I did was made a list of all my criteria of things I wanted in the show. And now it's not going to, you know, it's not the Vitamita Vegemin and it's not the Chocolate Factory because they're missing elements. For example, sets. We have to have the New York apartment, right? The Ricardo's apartment. If you don't have that, people will feel cheated. And we wanted the Tropicana because we wanted music for live theater. We wanted the Cuban thing. And just seeing Ricky, he is the band leader after all.
Right.
I wanted the theme of Lucy trying to get into the show, which was key and iconic. Looked for an episode where she does her cry.
right.
And in that, that thing.
All those little buttons. Yeah, yeah.
We, an episode where, honey, I'm home, that Ricky says. And then we wanted equal parts Fred and Ethel.
Right.
And there's a lot of episodes I watch, goes, that's funny, that's there's no Fred in there. Or oh, darn, there's little Ricky, like traveling, you know, the W.C. Fields, kids and animals. One of my favorite episodes, Lucy goes on a diet. The funniest scene is a dog underneath the table when they're having dinner, and she's trying to fight the dog for, you know, she gets under there with him to fight for a piece of meat.
Right. Like, you know, because you just remind me of something, too, that it is true. When you think about the Lucy, the ones that really involve Fred and Ethel, they're usually very intricate and very, like, I immediately think of the feather pillows one with the ripping the feather pillows and, of course, those going everywhere. But I never thought about that. But there's a fairly good balance with in the two that you have. Now, the two that you do, it's Lucy goes to the eye doctor.
Lucy has her eyes examined, but that was very close.
Okay. And what was the other one is a
The Benefit.
The Benefit. Okay. It's a music, and Ricky has to do a benefit for something.
Ethel is trying to get him to do her ladies club benefit.
Okay.
Oh, yes. Right. I remember
But she goes through Lucy to, can you talk Ricky into doing this? And of course, Lucy's like, well, what if he had the both of us?
Oh,
and I love Ethel going, is that the only way we can get Ricky?
I really enjoyed the show when I saw it. It's going to be, I'm going to throw this information out there, and we'll definitely get it out there a couple more times before the end of the hour. It's been on tour for how long now? It's
coming since last July 2013.
Since last July. So,
we were in Chicago the year before.
Right,
about 5
right,
months,
okay.
And then it started the tour. And
but it started here.
It originated here.
It started right here in this in this radio studio.
Yeah, they, right, and man, was it crowded.
Yeah. Well, the audience coming in and all.
Yeah.
The Greenway Court Theater on Fairfax,
right?
Right across from, well, not across from Cantor's, but close enough to Cantor's. But it's going to be playing March 18th through the 23rd only at Segerstrom Center for the Arts.
Which is beautiful.
Have you been there?
Yes.
I've never been there.
Yeah.
600 Town Center Drive in Costa Mesa, California. Tickets start at $29. I can't believe this. $29 available at ilovelucylive.com. And for groups, and it's a great group show, 714-755-0236. Website again, ilovelucylive.com. And as I said, we'll throw that out there a few more times.
I don't have a copy of that.
You don't have that?
I don't.
Oh, that's
all right. That's all right. You do.
Heads will roll.
Oh, you don't have a detailed bio of Kim?
I do not.
It's okay. I made most of it up.
That's odd. Oh, that's
all right.
Curious.
It's all right. We'll,
what are you
going to
do?
We'll share.
What are you
going to
do?
I have Rick Sparks is a friend of mine.
Yes.
And I've got a couple friends that are in the cast, Jamie Lake and Carlos
wonderful.
Martin. And they are so grateful to be in this show and having so much fun doing it.
And we're grateful that they're in the show.
Yeah, and I'm so sorry I didn't get to see it when it was in L.A. So
maybe, shame on you.
So go to Costa Mesa.
Yeah, I have to
next
go
week.
To pack a bag and yeah. check into a hotel when I go that far away.
It's not that
It'll
far.
It'll be great, though. That's a great theater. It's
yeah.
great. It's selling like gangbusters.
Yeah, well, I'm sure.
And we had so many people in L.A. in 2011 because it was a 99-seat theater that didn't get to see it. In fact, some angry people.
You said that like Lucy fans are militant, right?
Oh, I mean, there's all the different variances of Lucy fans,
okay.
but there is in there.
They're the ones
the
that have to be
ones.
500 yards away from the theater.
There's look at my full tattoo covering my leg of Lucille Ball, or it runs the gambit.
What do you think?
I'm going to forego the obvious joke there.
But what do you think? Really, seriously, what do you think? Goes on in people's minds that they would go to that extent to be so compulsive about something.
Well, from what we found with our show, and I think this extends, is there's a weird emotional connection to I Love Lucy. It's not just a sitcom, but people have this emotional thing, and it might be where they were when they used to watch it, whether it was original or reruns. Stories, people identify, always have people coming up, oh, well, we named our dogs, Lucy and Ethel, or there's something there that goes beyond.
Right. I think that,
some people come out in tears.
Oh,
because it touches that.
I tell you something, to echo that, I didn't realize how much it was going to, when I saw it, I was like, okay, it's going to be, it's I Love Lucy, it'll be fun. We know it'll be funny. It's, we know that. But when they go to the Tropicana for the first time, and Desi, the gentleman, Bill
Mendieta,
who plays phenomenal, who we had on the show, actually.
We did. Yeah. We had both him and
Sierra,
Serena Irwin.
Serena, yeah.
Who play Lucy and Rick. When he's there, and they're in that, and he's in that spotlight, and he's got the drum, and he's about to do the whole Babalu thing, it's very powerful because it's so iconic. It's so, it just... For those of us that grew up watching the show, even if we didn't grow up in the 50s, if I was born in 64, but it grew up, it was still a fixture on television. And it was very moving. It was a very striking image. And I'm sure that's a big charge of what the people get. Also, the Hispanic community, amazing connection with the Hispanic community.
Exactly.
One of the first people to speak Spanish on television was Desi Arnaz.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So I never realized that, because I remember when it was at Greenway, there was a huge Hispanic attendance.
I want to ask a question, especially from your point of view as a writer. Uh-huh. And, we all love Lucy. Who wouldn't and who can't and who doesn't? And however, there was a time that came in her life, later life, where, after doing such a brilliant body of work prior to I Love Lucy as an actress, and, some of these great films that she did.
And she was a vamp, too.
She was a hot little number.
Just,
such an interesting, multidimensional talent. Mm. But in her later years, I had often wished, when I would watch her on the Carson show or some of the Tonight Show, that she would stop, so that we could be left with all of these great, great memories. And she didn't. That, the I Love Lucy show, became something else and something else. And
yeah, there were about nine different incarnations, after Lucy.
And the more it became, it just kind of dropped off.
You should have written her letters. Please.
I should have.
Please stop.
Yes.
For me to preserve what I have.
Yeah.
Love, Michael.
Respect. like her.
I knew you would. I knew you would.
You know,
because I used to send letters to Desi. I just
you did.
That's what I would do.
We can't
letters.
Talk about those letters.
Love letters. Yeah, but that's a whole different show. Because when he held that drum. Oh,
you know who we had a couple weeks ago? We were in Fayetteville.
Into the mic, Steve. Laugh into the mic, if you would. Thank you. Thanks. That's what we're paying you
Wait,
for. Read the cards. Would you, Steve? Read the cards.
In Fayetteville, we had the most wonderful woman. Her name's Wanda Clark, and she was Lucy's secretary for 28 plus years until Lucy died. Not Wanda. Otherwise, I wouldn't have met her. And she came to the show, and it was really great to have someone who knew Lucille Ball so well to see it and, you know, was around that whole time. And she just adored it, and she had tons of stories and just the sweetest gal.
Yeah,
and we also have coming next week, he came to the Greenway show, Frank Gorey, who is Lucy. She hired him as her limo driver in 1958, and he was with the family and helped manage the house in Beverly Hills up until she died. And so he's coming for the second time, which will be really fun.
Do you know who Lee Tannen is? He wrote a book about her. He was a very, very close friend of hers toward the later part of her
life.
And it's an interesting book. He has some very personal stories to share, which some are shocking and others are charming.
Didn't some of the, speaking of the old friends, weren't some of the kids of the writers in attendance at some point, the families of the writers?
Well, Jess Oppenheimer's son has come to the show several times.
And the three were, and it was two men and a woman. It was Jess Oppenheimer, and who were the other two? Do you remember? I'm trying to think.
Oh, Madeline Pugh.
Madeline Pugh.
Her son and daughter-in-law.
Okay. I wish I could remember, because the thing is, I remember seeing them recognized in the program, the three writers, because they did adaptations of these episodes, and then, of course, all the architecture that's around these episodes had to be written. But it always impressed me when I look at the credits of those shows. I Love Lucy, Your Show of Shows, The Honeymooners, tiny little nucleuses of writers. And then you look at Saturday Night Live, which debatable how funny it is, but there's like 30 writers to create, and it just really goes to show that it's quality and not quantity when it comes
and
to
And I agree with you, and I think that's probably why Saturday Night Live isn't as funny as it used to be.
Too many cooks.
I don't think they had that many writers when it first started.
No, they didn't. They didn't. But I know. I don't want to take writers' jobs away, but, you know.
I just want to say one thing to our audience out there. What I'm saying with regard to Lucy is I truly do love Lucy, and I love every episode that she's ever done, and I would see them over and over again to the point where I couldn't for a night. I had to go off for a week, and then I went back.
The Maharinsis.
Yes, and so to go and see this show live just must be very, very special. So I guess that answers the question about why people show up and with the tattoos and the things,
and Lucy was unlike Milton Berle, because I was a huge Ernie Kovacs fan, big Lucy fan, big Sid Caesar fan, hated Milton Berle because because Milton Berle, Lucy was like a smart silly. Lucy was like a Monty Python type silly, and Berle was just silly for silly's sake. I never found Lucy to be juvenile. I found that there was a real cleverness to the funny, you know, and same with Kovacs and same with Gleason. You know, there's a real clean account. But anyway.
Did you write him letters?
I did, but I was asked to stop.
Not,
yes.
I do not prefer your form of comedy.
Stop. Yes. Thank you. It's real. But I hear you're hung like a cave bear. We're talking about I Love Lucy Live, and I just mentioned Milton Berle's genitalia, which, you know, it's amazing where we go on this
show.
Thank
you for coupling it for
do you like that?
Sake.
Yes.
Wow.
I Love Lucy Live is playing March 18th through the 23rd at Segerstrom Center for the Arts. That's in Costa Mesa, 600 Town Center Drive. For tickets, ilovelucylive.com or group 714-755-0236. And we will definitely throw this out there again before the end of the hour. But right now we have an arts calendar we have to touch on.
Yes, we do.
So, Michael, if you don't mind, can I kick that off? Because I know that you've been an active theater goer.
Yeah.
Confused by Confucius? Thoroughly thrown by Thoreau? Wish Swift was swifter, Tennyson tinier? Then buckle up and hop aboard as America's best-loved comedy troupe zips through everything you were supposed to read in school but probably didn't. No classic escapes the slings and arrows of outrageous satire in this captivating production. The literary canon explodes as the three cultural gorillas of the reduced Shakespeare Company take you on a hilarious 98-minute roller coaster ride through its compact compendium of the 83 greatest books in the history of Western literature, I believe, with literature, written and directed by Reed Martin and Austin Tichenor. I hope I'm getting that right. With additional material by Matthew Croak and Michael Faulkner. All the Great Books plays through March 30th at the Laguna Playhouse at 606 Laguna Canyon Road in Laguna Beach. And, boy, that's a lot of lagunas in one set.
Yeah.
But that sounds very funny. It's right up my alley. It's like a literary spoofing. I always enjoy that. Michael, as I said, you were at the Amundsen recently.
I was last night at the opening of Barry Manilow's Harmony. And I must say, what an opening it was. It was very star-studded. Michael Feinstein was there, Suzanne Somers, all these people that are very friendly with Barry. And wow, it was a very, very, truly kind of great fun evening to see a show that was very much anticipated. And
was Barry there?
Oh, yes.
Really?
Of course he was. Yeah.
But you didn't mention him. That's why.
Yes. You know. No. Well, he wasn't. He was actually an audience member, and it was very exciting. So, touched by the magic that truly is the music of Barry Manilow, plus the creative passion of his colleague, book and lyric writer Bruce Sussman, ingenious direction by Tony Special, extraordinary music direction by John O'Neill, delightfully inventive choreography by Joanne M. Hunter, and a superb, and I do mean superb, cast led by Matt Bailey, Will Blum, Chris Dwan, Shane Kenyon, Will Taylor, and Douglas Williams, with strong, solid support from Hannah Corneau. How would you say that?
Corneau?
Yes, I'll go for that. Corneau. That's pretty.
Corneau.
Leanne Larkin. Harmony, a new musical by Barry Manilow and Bruce Sussman, became a reality of majestic proportions last night at the Los Angeles Center Theater Group's Amundsen Theater. Nurturing this true story of six widely loved German men called the Comedian Harmonists, composed of three young Jews and three young Gentiles during the late 1920s and 30s, and the mid-30s, each with superstar talents. The bright and upbeat scenario eventually turns dark and alarming as the revered group eventually fear for their lives during the Nazi occupation and a historic time that will never be forgiven or forgotten. Saying it just right with memorable music and distinct lyrics and truthful words, Manilow and Sussman were in perfect harmony when they deservedly took their curtain call last night, surrounded by a spectacular company in front of a sold-out, insatiable audience, proving that this harmony has all the makings of a major Broadway marquee attraction.
Oh, wow.
Let's hear a little bit.
Yeah, I'm going to play a little clip
song
of it. This is the title track. Ooh. Okay, and this is from Harmony, a new musical.
This was our time. Harmony.
Did we have
harmony?
But that's just about all we
poverty's
not so
bad.
Then we were
poor as hell
in Berlin.
We were
patches on our
pants.
Partially, when you're in harmony, you're in a trance. Others went marching. Not us, we danced. Oi!
Wow.
Yeah, we'll play the rest of that on the way out of the show today. But
and that's a YouTube clip, too, that people should know. They do a search on YouTube for Harmony by Barry Manilow, and the audio that they just heard, they can see it performed live.
They can, and they can also see
the magic of the interweb.
Yeah, they could also go to the, when they buy their tickets, because it's now on stage through April 13th.
And those tickets are available at thecentertheatergroup.org, and that's theater with an R-E, so centertheatergroup.org, the CTG box office located at the Amundsen Theater, or by calling 213-972-4400. And I want to tell you something from top to bottom, lighting, sets, anything and everything about this production was spectacular.
Well, I mean, the thing is, you know, there's two nice things about that. You know, if Manilow's attached, you know how the music is going to be. But also just the people that someone of that stature attracts, you know, you're going to get some top-notch
people. If I had anything critically to say about it, would be certainly constructive. But it might a little fine tweaking, you know, in the first act, maybe here and there, just so slight. But
oh, now I'm not going.
No, you must go. It really is.
I'm kidding.
It's just, you know, that's why it's there. That's why it's opening there, and that's why it's on its way to Broadway. So
awesome. Well, thank you, Michael.
Absolutely.
Write him a letter.
I will.
Write him a letter.
I already
the
have.
Tweaking.
Michael, would you introduce Steve for our lovely listeners?
Of course,
and
I will.
Give him the intro he is so due.
Absolutely. Our next guest, ladies and gentlemen, was recently quoted as saying, "I've always found the performing arts to be a masterful outlet for young adults to find their voice, particularly during the ages where we are all looking to find comfort in our own skin. While I always had a deep appreciation for adult actors who took the time to perform skits for us when I was in middle of high school, I always felt that the impact of these messages would increase tenfold if I could just see them performed by people my own age. As young adults, we spend most of our adolescence learning from each other, so why not on stage?" These observations led to the creation of Phantom Projects Theater Group, and our next guest is the founder of that organization, which will present No Way to Treat a Lady May 15th at at La Mirada Theater for the Performing Arts. Please welcome Steve Cisneros. Rock and roll here. For you.
Oh, Steve. Kim, put your top back on. That's really inappropriate.
I wish I got that music.
I tell Steve, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good.
You've been such a gentleman so quietly sitting there.
And he turns away from the mic when he laughs. I had to tell him.
Right?
You know.
Well, he's a class act.
Steve, this organization is really fascinating to me because years ago when I was in Chicago, I worked for a group called HealthWorks Theater, and we did AIDS awareness. I was in a theater company in the late 80s, early 90s, and we lost many members during that period of time to AIDS. And so we did this thing where we toured high schools with two health-related shows for kids. One was called The Wizard of AIDS, which was about modes of submission and modes of, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, the
that word.
Transmission.
Yeah, okay. And the other one, thank you. And the other one was the world's first prenatal care musical, Don't Wait Until You See Me, which is about, you know, which we did, which was a lot of fun. But what was the catalyst for creating this this organization? Was it personal experience or?
Well, twofold.
One, not to pry too much.
Twofold. One was when assemblies would come to our schools as a student, it would always be people three times our age. And immediately, as soon as they walked out, they would try to relate to the audience members, and it was just not going to happen. And within the first 3 minutes, everyone was tuned out. No one paid attention. And by the time it was over, we definitely had no idea what was going on in front of us. The second element was my own. I was very lucky at the age of 17 to have had a lot of theatrical experience and a lot of great community theaters. And when I graduated high school, I was all set to join the professional theatrical world, ready to add my creative expertise. And at 17, I looked 12, and people would look at me and say, there's no way we're hiring you, or no way we're hiring you. So I thought, well, if no one's going to give me a chance to be this masterful 17-year-old that I felt that I was, I will create my own company now. I'll just do it myself. And so we started off doing school assemblies. I thought, okay, well, let me get some friends together. We'll take a script that our co-founder, Bruce Gewurzman, wrote. He's my old high school English teacher. And we took these plays he wrote for teens, and I put my friends in them, essentially. And we did a group performance. We invited local teachers and said, hey, here's an idea we have. What if we took this school assembly to your school? And after one night, we had a 5-month booking, and all
wow.
these teachers came in, and just we couldn't book shows fast enough. And you know, if I knew what I knew then, I would have never started it because I had no idea what I was doing. Now I'm, you know, studying workers' comp and insurance, all these things that you know
the joy of theater.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I started it all for, but you know, and we started rehearsing in my parents' garage, and it was just, and we grew so fast. And 2 years later, we added more shows, one about drug prevention, one about bullying and racism, and then shortly after of that, we thought, well, you know, there's a lot of young audiences out there who want to keep seeing what we're doing. How can we expand? And so we teamed up with the La Mirada Theater of Performing Arts, and now we do not only our message-based shows with the teen performers, but now we do full-scale main stage shows with adult actors and performers, and we do shows based on books that people are reading in school. So To Kill a Mockingbird, Of Mice and Men, Grapes of Wrath, Diary of Anne Frank, everything we read in school that wasn't necessarily written for teen audiences. I mean, Steinbeck wasn't trying to write
so live,
Twilight.
You're live Cliff Notes. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's funny you say that, because a lot of kids are like, oh, this book is so boring. Yeah. And they walk out of the show and they're like, oh, I get it now. Yeah. You know, yeah. And so we reach them. And so we help parents because it gets their young people to see shows. We help young people because they get to experience art for the first time often.
So important.
And we help teachers because we get to expand their curriculum. You know, they're having a hard time. We get teachers all the time saying, I'm trying to make this book interesting. I'm trying to make this come to life. It's not happening. You know, and we love coming to your shows because you get to take what I'm teaching in class and you're putting it in a way that's so accessible. And so whether it's the adult actors doing the adult shows or it's our message-based shows that we still do at La Mirada Theater and on tour, where we do bring in teen performers, you know, and they connect with those teen audiences.
So now in terms of connecting with the teen audience and the subject matter of the issues that they encounter, teen pregnancy, the ones that you mentioned already, how are those scripts arrived at? Are they workshops? Is it just scripted by somebody? Or because, I mean, obviously the literary things of Mice and Men and that sort of thing, we know where you're starting.
Sure, yeah.
But where do those other ones start?
Well, when I was 17, I had a great teacher, Bruce Gewurzman, who would be teaching for 35 years. And every year he would write a play to be performed on the campus of La Mirada High School. And it was just his speech and debate team that would do these plays, and they would never see the light of day again. They would go away. But it was a huge event on campus every year. So I went to him and said, you know, Mr. G, I had this idea for a company. Can I have your scripts, essentially? And I think like no other playwright in the world would ever say, he said, yes, take them, do what you will. You know, you're the age basis is geared towards, so you can take control of these scripts and do what you will.
Wow.
So he took them and you know, of course, from the shows they were 17 years ago to where they are now, we have adapted them, we changed them. The young performers who are now 17 or younger, you know, people born in the year 2000, which blows my mind, who are in these plays, you know, they put their input and their thought process. And so I take that and we adapt our show so that our current audiences are getting a more accurate feel of young people and how they feel today.
Wow.
So, you know, I'd be totally incompetent if I kept the script the same every year, because young people are changing when you add social media and you know, sexting and things like that.
Yeah.
There are new topics that wasn't around even just 8 years ago in a lot of ways. So we definitely keep our topics fresh. And No Way to Treat a Lady, which we're doing in May, was the show our company started off with 17 years ago. So we're bringing it back to kind of, because it is our 17th anniversary.
No, No Way to Treat a Lady. That's the one that's going to be at La Mirada. And this is, for our listeners, that's La Mirada Boulevard in La Mirada, 14900 La Mirada Boulevard. Tickets for that one, which is May 15th,
correct,
is when that's happening.
Correct.
The box office there, 562-944-9801 or 714-994-6310. Your website is phantomprojects.com. But what is the, can you give us a little synopsis of No Way to Treat a Lady?
Sure, yeah. It's about teen pregnancy prevention, it's not a sex ed show by any means. It doesn't talk about what sex is. We definitely know kids know what sex is already, or else the show wouldn't be needed. It's about teen relationships. It's about respect. It's about encompassing all elements of the pressures that young people go through. It's about the guy who, you know, isn't trying to be a jerk by sleeping with girls, but it just doesn't know how to control his hormones. I mean, let's face it, guys have hormones and they want to act on those. And they're not necessarily trying to be jerks about it, but they're following their instincts. Then you have the good guy who gets the pressure because, oh, you're a wuss. Why aren't you trying to get what you can from your girlfriend? You know, why aren't you trying to, you know, and he's just trying to be a good guy. We get the girls who, you know, the old famous, but he told me he loved me. You know, that element. The 14-year-old girl who does get pregnant and the choices she has to make with that pregnancy. And it's all youth cast for that show. We always do one message-based show a year at the theater. All teen cast. A post-show discussion with the audience afterwards.
Great.
And the audience and the cast members. And, you know, what better way to get advice as an audience member than from other 14-year-olds, 15-year-olds on stage who are going through the exact same thing they're going through.
What's the casting process? I mean, you'll auditions, obviously, have you ever thought of putting, you know, Disney is a great supporter of now on their programming for their television series, which are actually really well written.
Absolutely.
Because they're being written by all of the network guys that have now come over to Disney. And they certainly have a very ethnic group of young stars in their stable of stars. It'd be kind of cool maybe to approach them and to do one of your pieces of work.
You know what's funny? They actually start with us. We had three girls from our company who now have their own Disney Channel shows.
Really?
So, yeah. So wow. A lot of our actors who start off at a young age go. In fact, one of our founding actresses, Courtney Draper, was on one of the very first Disney original TV shows. Mm-hmm. A girl, Piper, who's on a show. I think it's called I Didn't Do It. It's a brand new series.
Yes,
she was
on
our show last year with us.
I just happened to see it.
Is that right? Yeah. She's a very talented young girl. So a lot of our actresses have gone on as they become adult or older teens to work with Disney and other great TV series, Boardwalk Empire, 12 Years a Slave.
Wow.
A lot of people started off in fandom projects who've gone on to greater
things.
Oh, wow.
And you know, I recently interviewed two of their stars, the young man that's on Modern Family who plays the son.
Sure.
And then the young lady who's a supporting character on Austin and Ally, which is a big Disney hit show. And they're both, what's interesting about them is they are super smart, these kids.
Absolutely.
I mean, it was like talking to two adults.
Yeah. Well.
Now, I don't know whether they were that way when they started or they have become that way through the process of
the challenge of when we travel to schools and or bring schools to us. The kids are getting so smart. They are so smart. I mean, they're so ahead of the curve on so many things that you've got to almost be five steps ahead of them in order to teach them or talk
right.
to them because they're going to call you out on it.
Right. The instant they feel that they're being talked down to, you've lost them.
Absolutely.
So you got to take two steps. But you bring up something that I want the listeners to know. You have this sort of home at La Mirada, mm-hmm. but when you do these satellite productions, or do people just call you, hire you, and basically bring the show out? And is it just that simple?
Indeed, yeah. They give us a call, visit our website. We can take a lot of our message-based shows, not our book shows like To Kill a Mockingbird, things like that,
right.
but our message-based shows, travel to middle schools, high schools, youth groups, churches, any gathering of young people there are, we can bring it to your facility and we can adapt to any space. We've done as small as little classrooms to some schools have theaters as nice as La Mirada Theater. I mean, some groups have some great facilities that we can bring into all of them. And it's funny, going back to the casting question, a lot of our performers, we use Breakdown actually. We use Breakdown backstage, Actors Access, all those things. But a lot of our audience members, or a lot of our actors, started off as audience members.
Ah.
They saw us at school and say, I loved what you did. I want to be a part of that. I'm not necessarily an actor, but I'm an advocate. Or I'm not necessarily, you know, I want to be on stage teaching my peers, talking to my peers, utilizing my talent to help people. And it's funny, our audience, our actors become either actors mm-hmm. or teachers.
Wow.
I think it's the most accurate split of where our young people go off to once they leave, you know.
And I tell you, that really says something, because to be moved enough to enjoy something is one thing, but to be moved enough to want to be part of it, because especially when you figure, I mean, that high school mentality, going up on that stage is such a step of it's such a place of vulnerability.
Absolutely.
If you're at that teenage thing and then you feel strongly enough about something to go up there and just be vulnerable in front of a whole group of people, you really have to be affecting people.
And especially with these topics, the audience members are not afraid to get personal. You know, so when you do a whole show about teen pregnancy and relationships, they're going to say, do you guys actually believe this stuff, or are you just reading a script?
Yeah.
And they will say, my question is for you. What do you do in this situation?
Wow.
And the actors, you know, the actors, I mostly use that term for them for these message-based shows, because they're people who perform, is how we kind of call them, because they're not acting. They're putting up real life. They're bringing out their own stories into this, and they're talking about their personal lives and are not afraid to share that with everyone so that the audience members can either learn from their mistakes. Our actors aren't all perfect. They're either bringing their own life stories of mistakes or talking about how they've always maintained their strong mentality towards making the right choices. You know, so they hear both sides.
A phenomenal organization.
Thank you.
When you do the title shows that you have, is it a combination of adults and young people doing
these
things?
Well, we cast age-appropriate.
Right.
So when we did Diary of Anne Frank, our Anne Frank was a young 14-year-old girl, and Otto Frank was a 60-year-old man. You know,
good.
So
we
cast everyone. But the one key thing is we do cast children in our children roles. So when we did Anne Frank, a lot of 19 to 25-year-old girls who could have played Anne wonderfully, but we make it a point to say if it's a 14-year-old character, we're going to find a 14-year-old girl, because the audience members are going to relate to her that much more.
Which is one of my objections in musical theater, actually, because even here in Los Angeles...
Are you saying you didn't like my performance as Anne Frank in the Anne Frank the musical?
Careful.
Not exactly.
But there's a great
you
great,
must tell that story.
Great David Sedaris story about that. But sorry.
No, go ahead. That's it.
Oh, well, David Sedaris tells a story about there being a horrible, horrible production in London's West End of Pia Zadora, vanity production, where Pia Zadora was Anne Frank.
Oh, my God.
And so roundly trounced that when Nazis stormed the stage in Act 3, an audience member was prompted to stand up and shout, "She's in the attic!"
That's hilarious.
And he told it, and then it turns out that it's an urban legend. But when he told the story, he didn't realize there was never a production with her. And it's really funny because he ends the lecture by saying, "So I'll never tell that story." Yeah. And of course, he does with everything.
Yeah, but my point was in musical theater, for example, they often hire, like in Greece, they'll hire instead of hiring age-appropriate actors or actresses that can play these roles. They feel they can't find them to play them efficiently enough, so they hire older actors in a big theater, they kind of get away with it a little bit. But a lot of the time, though,
that's the issue of the cost, because, you know, if you have anyone under a certain age, you know, you can only work them so much time during a day. Well, you have to have a tutor.
Right.
You know, I'm saying that I think a lot of those decisions are made monetarily, unfortunately.
And you usually can get away with it, but with the young audiences, we bus in so many thousands of young people, even the kid in the very last row. The first thing they're going to say is, "You're old."
Yeah,
she's 21.
Exactly.
You know, if it's a 21-year-old girl who's 5'1", they're going to say, "You're old."
You're old.
But if you're 14, suddenly it's, you can do this. So not only are they inspired by Anne Frank's character, but by the actress. And, you know, they're sucked in from all angles at that point.
So your whole goal is not to get any kid in that audience to roll their eyes. That would be the worst thing possible.
Absolutely. And the parents. You know, the parents can enjoy it as a real piece of theater, and young people can enjoy it because they can relate to it.
Yeah.
So, everybody.
Michael, did I give you the information on No Way to Treat a Lady? Do you have that handy?
I do have some things handy. Yes, the top, I do have it.
Would you throw that information out, and I'll throw out the I Love Lucy stuff.
For getting tickets? Is that what we're talking
about? For No Way to Treat a Lady at La Mirada on May 15th.
I believe that's... You know... Why, do you not have it in front of you?
No, I do. I just felt bad about neglecting you with the Lucy information.
You know what? Because I actually... Oh, here's Kim's bio.
Oh,
now.
You do have it.
There
yeah.
we go.
Oh, what's on the next page?
It's stuck together.
Oh, Kel Surprise.
And somebody got fired a half
it's
hour ago.
No Way to Treat...
Yeah. The way it goes.
Yeah, our extensive staff. No Way to Treat a Lady will be at May 15th at La Mirada Performing Arts Center. That's 14900... La Mirada Boulevard in La Mirada. Tickets 562-944-9801 or visit phantomprojects.com.
And I just wanted to bring up one thing. You are an award-winning organization.
We have been recognized. Yes, we have.
NAACP
awards? We were nominated
for
2 NAACP awards, and we've received many awards from throughout the state from different legislators and individuals who've reached out to recognize, you know, what we do with young people and for local communities. So, yeah, we've been very happy with that.
You've got some, you know, fantastic funding that only theaters could dream of getting.
The City of La Mirada and the La Mirada Theater are wonderful to us, and we've got some great neighbors at McQuarrie Rigby Entertainment and everybody who helps us do what we do. And our tickets are only, you know, $7 for No Way to Treat a Lady. And that's not reflective of the quality of the show, but the need for the young people.
To get in.
Does McQuarrie Rigby get involved with you at all?
They help us a lot with access to their inventory. Tom and Kathy are very good.
They
and they're
I'm
wonderful
talking about
people.
Kathy Rigby.
Yeah,
her
Kathy Rigby.
Tom,
yeah.
They're wonderful people who are very supportive of us and us of them if we can.
And
be,
they're always cranking stuff out there. I get their mailer, I get their calendar, and there's always so much stuff going
good
on.
Stuff.
Yeah. Before we get to the last part, I want to give the Lucy information one more time. This is I Love Lucy Live, playing March 18th through the 23rd only at Segerstrom Center for the Arts. That's in Costa Mesa, 600 Town Center Drive. Tickets, ilovelucylive.com, or for groups, can call 714-755-0236. And that, once again, that's only playing 18th to the 23rd, so try to catch it while it's
and,
here.
And, ladies and gentlemen, Harmony, as I told you, at the Amundsen Theater, centertheatergroup.org, or their box office on site there, or by calling 213-972-4400. Harmony plays at the Amundsen Theater through April 13th.
2.5 minutes. Our guests, you have a story to share about the worst thing to happen, or some not worst thing, but...
I do. One of our shows for our teen audiences, we were using an Xbox as our DVD player to project videos, which was used throughout the entire show, and the projector went out on us, but the audio still worked, and 1,300 teens recognized the sound of the Xbox making its Xbox sound. And luckily, it was the very top of the show. We were able to recover and went off without a hitch. But, you know, if it was in the middle, the whole thing would have been ruined at that point. But as soon as they heard that, boop, boop. That's every kid just went laughing. They knew it was an Xbox scale. We were using. An adult audience, they would have never recognized that sound.
No.
But
I didn't even know it when you said that.
Yeah, they knew that Xbox sound. It was like, oh.
I don't even know what an Xbox is.
That's hilarious.
Do you have one, Kim?
I don't know. I mean, I have little ones for Lucy. I have one from the Santa Claus, the movie The Santa Claus with Tim Allen.
Yes, yeah.
And it was, you know, he had.
Did you write this, Bill?
No. I wrote on it. Yeah. Worked on it, yeah. And I didn't. I punched up, as we say in the business. Tim had to have the fat suit on, you know, when he was Santa. Yeah. And it's you know, a couple hundred pounds, or I don't know, 120 pounds. And it was miserable, and he was hot, and he was a very cranky Santa. And there were all kinds of little kids playing elves on the set, you know, that kind of thought he might be Santa because they're at that age. They didn't know. But it was the executives that wanted to bring their kid. I'll take you to the set. Like the Disney executive, and introduce you to Santa. And he would be in his trailer, and there was some guy, his whole job was to take a hose and shove it kind of up his crotch underneath the fat layers, the suit. And it was just a horrible scene, and his jacket would be off, and this kid would come into the trailer. I was there when it was like, oh, no, oh, God. It walked in. Santa, you know, it was just. I'm sure scarred, scarred by that.
There's an image of Santa that
well,
I had.
Wait a minute, what was coming out of the hose? Was it water? Or?
No, it was air. It was like air conditioning, cool the man.
Yeah, you don't think they could have created a more friendly suit to be worn?
No. Not really. Yeah. And just the poor guy with that job.
No, because the thing is, it's not like a theme park costume. It's not made for that.
Yeah.
It's just for
it's
to be filmed.
Prosthetic, thick, yeah, you yeah. know, latex.
Oh man, oh, that's hysterical.
Poor child.
All right, we got to wrap it up. We are going to play the remainder or a little more of the title track from Harmony for our listeners.
Thank you, Kim, for being here.
Kim,
thank
and
you're
Steve.
Welcome.
So wonderful.
Thanks for having
us.
Great time. I like this.
And Paul, as always, we'll see you on the radio next week.
See you on the radio. And once again, Harmony, new musical at the Amundsen. Give it another listen.
Listening to State of the Art with Michael Sterling and Paul Strolley right here on LA Talk Radio.